Florence, but you knew all about Joyland over here in North Carolina, didn't you? I don't know if you're Carney from Carney, but you've never been able to stay away from the shows. And when you suggested a little road trip, she went along with it. I was her secret boyfriend. I told her I had to be because I was older. He smiled. She bought it. They all do. You'd be surprised how much the young ones will buy. You sick fuck, I thought. You sick, sick fuck. You brought her to Heaven's Bay, you stayed at a motel, and then you killed her here at Joyland, even though you must have known about the Hollywood girls running around with their cameras. Bold as brass. That was part of the kick, wasn't it? Sure it was. You did it on a ride full of conies. Rubes, he said. The hardest gust yet shook the spin, but he seemed not to feel it. Of course, he was on the inside of the wheel where things were a little calmer. Call them what they are. They're just rubes, all of them. They see nothing. It's like their eyes are connected to their assholes instead of their brains. Everything goes right through. You get off on risk, don't you? That's why you came back and hired on. Not even a month later, his smile widened. All this time I've been right here under their noses. And you know what? I've been, you know, good ever since that night in the funhouse. All the bad stuff was behind me. I could have gone on being good. I like it here. I was building a life. I had my gadget and I was going to patent it. Oh, I think sooner or later you would have done it again. We were back at the top. The wind and rain pelted us. I was shivering. My clothes were soaked. Lane's cheeks were dark with hair dye. It ran down his skin in tendrils. His mind is like that, I thought. On the inside where he never smiles. No, I was cured. I have to do you, Jonesy. But only because you stuck your nose in where it doesn't belong. It's too bad because I liked you. I really did. I thought he was telling the truth, which made what was happening even more horrible. We were going back down. The world below was windy and rain-soaked. There had been no car with its headlights out. Only a blowing piece of canvas that for a moment looked like that to my yearning mind. The cavalry wasn't coming. Thinking it would only get me killed. I had to do this myself, and the only chance I had was to make him mad. Really mad. You get off on risk, but you don't get off on rape, do you? If you did, you would have taken them to some isolated place. I think what your secret girlfriends have between their legs scares you limp. What do you do later? Lie in bed and jack off, thinking about how brave you are killing defenseless girls? Shut up! You can fascinate them, but you can't fuck them. The wind shouted. The car rocked. I was going to die, and at that moment I didn't give shit one. I didn't know how angry I was making him, but I was angry enough for the both of us. What happened to make you this way? Did your mother put a clothespin on your peepee when you went wee-wee in the corner? Did Uncle Stan make you give him a blowjob, or was it... Shut up! He rose into a crouch, gripping the safety bar in one hand and pointing the gun at me with the other. A stroke of lightning lit him up. Staring eyes, lank hair, working mouth, and the gun. Shut your dirty mouth! Devin, duck! I didn't think about it. I just did it. There was a whip-crack report, an almost liquid sound in the blowing night. The bullet must have gone right past me, but I didn't hear it or feel it the way characters do in books. The car we were in swept past the loading point, and I saw Annie Ross standing on the ramp with a rifle in her hands. The van was behind her. Her hair was blowing around her bone-white face. We started up again. I looked at Lane. He was frozen in his crouch. His mouth ajar, black dye ran down his cheeks. His eyes were rolled up so only the bottom half of the irises showed. Most of his nose was gone. One nostril hung down by his upper lip, but the rest of it was just a red ruin surrounding a black hole the size of a dime. He sat down on the seat, hard. Several of his front teeth rattled out of his mouth when he did. I plucked the gun from his hand and tossed it over the side. What I was feeling right then was nothing, except in some very deep part of me where I had begun to realize that this might not be my night to die after all. Oh, he said. Then he said, Then he slumped forward, chin on chest. He looked like a man considering his options, and very carefully. There was more lightning as the car reached the top. It illuminated my seatmate in a stutter of blue fire, The wind blew and the spin moaned in protest. We were coming down again. From below, almost lost in the storm.
Dev, how do I stop it?
I first thought of telling her to look for the remote control gadget. But in the storm, she could hunt for a half an hour and still not find it. Even if she did, it might be broken or lying shorted out in a puddle. Besides, there was a better way.
Go to the motor, I shouted. Look for the red button. Red button, Annie. It's the emergency stop.
I swept past her, registering the same jeans and sweater she had worn earlier, both now soaked and plastered to her. No jacket, no hat. She had come in a hurry, and I knew who had sent her. How much simpler it would have been if Mike had focused on Lane at the start. But Rosie never had, even though she had known him for years, and I was to find out later that Mike never focused on Lane Hardy at all. I was going back up again. Beside me, Lane's soaking hair was dripping black rain into his lap.
Wait until I come back down. What?
I didn't bother trying again. The wind would have drowned it out. I could only hope she wouldn't hammer on the red button while I was at the top of the ride. As the car rose into the worst of the storm, the lightning flashed again, and this time there was an accompanying crack of thunder. As if it had roused him, perhaps it had, Lane lifted his head and looked at me. Tried to look at me. His eyes had come back level in their sockets, but were now pointing in opposite directions. That terrible image has never left my mind, and it still comes to me at the oddest times. Going through the turnpike toll booths, drinking a cup of coffee in the morning with the CNN anchors baying bad news, getting up to piss at 3 a.m., which some poet or other has rightly dubbed as the hour of the wolf. He opened his mouth and blood poured out. He made a grinding insectal sound like a cicada burrowing into a tree. A spasm shook him. His feet tap danced briefly on the steel floor of the car. They stilled, and his head dropped forward again. Be dead, I thought. Please be dead this time. As the spin started down again, a bolt of lightning struck the thunderball. I saw the tracks light up briefly. I thought, that could have been me. The hardest gust of wind yet struck the car. I held on for dear life. Lane flopped like a big doll. I looked down at Annie, her face white, staring up, her eyes squinted against the rain. She was inside the rail, standing next to the motor. So far, so good. I put my hands around my mouth.
The red button! I see it! Wait until I tell you!
The ground was coming up. I grabbed the bar when the late, at least I hoped he was, Lane Hardy was at the control stick. The spin always came to an easy halt, the cars up top swaying gently. I had no idea what an emergency stop would be like, but I was going to find out.
Now, Annie, push it now!
It was a good thing I was holding on. My car stopped dead about 10 feet from the unloading point and still 5 feet above the ground. The car tilted. Lane was thrown forward, his head and torso flopping over the bar. Without thinking, I grabbed his shirt and pulled him back. One of his hands flopped into my lap, and I flung it away with a grunt of disgust. The bar wouldn't unlock, so I had to wriggle out from beneath it.
Be careful, Dev.
Annie was standing beside the car, holding up her hands as if to catch me. She had propped the rifle she used to end Hardy's life against the motor housing.
Step back,
I said, and threw one leg over the side of the car. More lightning flashed. The wind howled and the spin howled back. I got hold of a strut and swung out. My hand slipped on the wet metal and I dropped. I went to my knees. A moment later, she was pulling me to my feet.
Are you all right?
Yes. I wasn't, though. The world was swimming and I was on the edge of a faint. I lowered my head, gripped my legs just above my knees, and began taking deep breaths. For a moment, it could have gone either way, but then things began to solidify. I stood up again, careful not to move fast. It was hard to tell with the rain bucketing down, but I was pretty sure she was crying. I had to do it. He was going to kill you, wasn't he? Please, Dev, say he was going to kill you. Mike said he was, and... You can quit worrying about that, believe me, and I wouldn't have been the first. He's killed 4 women. I thought of Aaron's speculation about the years when there had been no bodies, none discovered at least. Maybe more, probably more. We have to call the police, there's a phone in... I started to point towards Mysterio's Mirror Mansion, but she grabbed my arm. No, you can't, not yet. Annie. She thrust her face close to mine, almost kissing distance, but kissing was the last thing on her mind. How did I get here? Am I supposed to tell the police that a ghost showed up in my son's room in the middle of the night and told him you'd die on the Ferris wheel if I didn't come? Mike can't be a part of this, and if you tell me I'm being an overprotective mom, I'll kill you myself. No, I said. I won't tell you that. So how did I get here? At first I didn't know. You have to remember that I was so scared myself. Only scared doesn't cover it. Scared isn't even in the ballpark. I was in shock. Instead of Mysterio's, I led her to her van and helped her sit behind the wheel. Then I went around and got in on the passenger side. By then, I had an idea. It had the virtue of simplicity, and I thought it would fly. I shut the door and took my wallet out of my hip pocket. I almost dropped it on the floor when I opened it. I was shaking like crazy. Inside, there were plenty of things to write on, but I had nothing to write with. Please tell me you have a pen or a pencil, Annie. Maybe in the glove compartment. You'll have to call the police, Dev. I have to get back to Mike. If they arrest me for leaving the scene or something, or for murder. Nobody's going to arrest you, Annie. You saved my life. I was pawing through the glove compartment as I talked. There was an owner's manual, piles of gasoline credit card receipts, Rolaids, a bag of M&Ms, even a Jehovah's Witness pamphlet asking if I knew where I was going to spend the afterlife. But no pen or pencil. You can't wait. In a situation like that, that's what I was always told. Her words came in chunks because her teeth were chattering. Just aim and squeeze before you can, you know, second guess yourself. It was supposed to go between his eyes, but the wind, I guess the wind. She shot out a hand and gripped my shoulder hard enough to hurt. Her eyes were huge. Did I hit you too, Dev? There's a gash in your forehead and blood on your shirt. You didn't hit me. He pistol whipped me a little, that's all. Annie, there's nothing in here to write with. But there was. A ballpoint at the very back of the glove compartment. Printed on the barrel, faded but still legible, was Let's Go Krogering. I won't say that pen saved Annie and Mike Ross serious police trouble, but I know it saved them a lot of questions about what had brought Annie to Joyland on such a dark and stormy night. I passed her the pen and a business card from my wallet, blank side up. Earlier, sitting in my car and terribly afraid that my failure to buy a new battery was going to get Annie and Mike killed, I thought I'd go back into the house and call her, only I didn't have her number. Now, I told her to write it down. And below the number, write, call if plans change. While she did, I started the van's engine and turned the heater on full blast. She returned the card. I tucked it into my wallet and shoved the wallet back into my pocket and tossed the pen into the glove compartment. I took her in my arms and kissed her cold cheek. Her trembling didn't stop, but it eased. You saved my life, I said. Now let's make sure nothing happens to you or Mike because you did. Listen very carefully. She listened. 6 days later, Indian Summer came back to Heaven's Bay for a brief final fling. It was perfect weather for a noon meal at the end of the Ross Boardwalk, only we couldn't go there. Newsmen and photographers had it staked out. They could do that because unlike the 2 acres surrounding the Big Green Victorian, the beach was public property. The story of how Annie had taken out Lane Hardy, known then and forever after as the Carney Killer, with one shot, had gone nationwide. Not that the stories were bad, quite the opposite. The Wilmington paper had led with, "Daughter of Evangelist Buddy Ross Bags Carney Killer." The New York Post was more succinct. "Hero Mom." It helped that there were file photos from Annie's salad days where she looked not just gorgeous, but smoking hot. Inside View, the most popular of the supermarket tabloids back then, put out an extra edition. They had unearthed the photo of Annie at 17, taken after a shooting competition at Camp Perry. Clad in tight jeans, an NRA t-shirt, and cowboy boots, she was standing with an antique Purdy shotgun broken over one arm and holding up a blue ribbon in her free hand. Next to the smiling girl was a mugshot of Lane Hardy at 21, after an arrest in San Diego under his real name, which was Leonard Hopgood, for indecent exposure. The two pics made a terrific contrast. The headline, Beauty and the Beast. Being a minor hero myself, I got some mention in the North Carolina papers, but in the tabloids, I was hardly mentioned. Not sexy enough, I guess.
Mike thought having a hero mom was cool. Annie loathed the whole circus and couldn't wait for the press to move on to the next big thing. She had gotten all the newspaper coverage she wanted in the days when she had been the holy man's wild child, famous for dancing on bars and various Greenwich Village dives. So she gave no interviews, and we had our farewell picnic in the kitchen. There were actually five of us, because Milo was under the table, hoping for scraps, and Jesus, on the face of Mike's kite, was propped in the extra chair. Their bags were in the hall. When the meal was done, I would drive them to Wilmington International. A private jet laid on by Buddy Ross Ministries, Inc. would fly them to Chicago and out of my life. The Heavens Bay Police Department, not to mention the North Carolina State Police and maybe even the FBI, would undoubtedly have more questions for her, and she'd probably be back at some point to testify before a grand jury, but she'd be fine. She was the hero mom, and thanks to the promotional pen from Kroger's in the back of the van's glove compartment, there would never be a photo of Mike in the Post below a headline reading, Psychic Savior. Our story was simple, and Mike played no part in it. I had gotten interested in the murder of Linda Gray because of the legend that her ghost haunted the Joyland Funhouse. I had enlisted the help of my research-minded friend and summer co-worker Aaron Cook. The photographs of Linda Gray and her killer had reminded me of someone, but it wasn't until after Mike's day at Joyland that the penny dropped. Before I could call the police, Lane Hardy had called me, threatening to kill Annie and Mike if I didn't come to Joyland on the double. So much truth, and only one little lie. I had Annie's phone number so I could call her if plans for Mike's visit to the park changed. I produced the card for the lead detective, who barely glanced at it. I said I called Annie from Mrs. Shoplaw's before leaving for Joyland, telling her to lock her doors, call the cops, and stay put. She did lock the doors, but didn't stay put. Nor did she call the police. She was terrified that if Hardy saw blue flashing lights, he'd kill me. So she'd taken one of the guns from the safe and followed Lane with her headlights off, hoping to surprise him, which she did. Thus, hero mom. "How's your father taking all this, Dev?" Annie asked. "Aside from saying he'd come to Chicago and wash your cars for life if you wanted?" She laughed, but my father had actually said that. "He's fine. I'm heading back to New Hampshire next month. We'll have Thanksgiving together. Fred asked me to stay on until then, help him get the park buttoned up, and I agreed. I can still use the money."
"For school?"
"Yeah. I guess I'll go back for the spring semester. Dad's sending me an application." "Good. That's where you need to be, not painting rides and replacing light bulbs in an amusement park."
"You'll really come see us in Chicago, right?" Mike asked. "Before I get too sick?"
Annie stirred uneasily but said nothing.
"I have to," I said and pointed to the kite. "How else am I going to return that? You said it was just a loan."
"Maybe you'll get to meet my grandpa. Other than being crazy about Jesus, he's pretty cool." He gave his mother a sideways glance. "I think so, anyway. He's got this great electric train set in his basement."
I said, "Your grandfather may not want to see me, Mike. I almost got your mother in a whole peck of trouble."
"He'll know you didn't mean to. It wasn't your fault that you worked with that guy." Mike's face grew troubled. He put down his sandwich, picked up a napkin, and coughed into it.
"Mr. Hardy seemed really nice. He took us on the rides."
"A lot of girls thought he was really nice, too," I thought.
"You never had a vibe about him?"
Mike shook his head and coughed some more.
"No. I liked him. And I thought he liked me."
I thought of Lane on the Carolina Spin calling Mike a crippled brat. Annie put a hand on Mike's wan of a neck and said,
"Some people hide their real faces, hon. Sometimes you can tell when they're wearing masks, but not always. Even people with powerful intuitions can get fooled."
I had come for lunch and to take them to the airport and to say goodbye, but I had another reason as well.
"I want to ask you something, Mike. It's about the ghost who woke you up and told you I was in trouble at the park. Is that okay? Will it upset you?"
"No. But it's not like on TV. There wasn't any white see-through thing floating around going, woo. I just woke up, and the ghost was there, sitting on my bed like a real person."
"I wish you wouldn't talk about this," Annie said. "Maybe it's not upsetting him, but it's sure as hell upsetting me.
I just have one more question, and then I'll let it go."
"Fine."
She began to clear the table. Tuesday, we had taken Mike to Joyland.
Not long after midnight on Wednesday morning, Annie had shot Lane Hardy on the Carolina Spin, ending his life and saving mine. The next day had been taken up by police interviews and dodging reporters. Then on Thursday afternoon, Fred Dean had come to see me, and his visit had nothing to do with Lane Hardy's death. Except I thought it did. Here's what I want to know, Mike. Was it the girl from the funhouse? Was she the one who came and sat on your bed? Mike's eyes went wide. Gosh, no. She's gone. When they go, I don't think they ever come back. It was a guy. In 1991, shortly after his 63rd birthday, my father suffered a fairly serious heart attack. He spent a week in Portsmouth General Hospital and then was sent home, with stern warnings about watching his diet, losing 20 pounds, and cutting out the evening cigar. He was one of those rare fellows who actually followed the doctor's orders. And at this writing, he's 85 and, except for a bad hip and dimming eyesight, still good to go. In 1973, things were different. According to my new research assistant, Google Chrome, the average stay back then was 2 weeks. The first in ICU, the second on the cardiac recovery floor. Eddie Parks must have done okay in ICU, because while Mike was touring Joyland on that Tuesday, Eddie was being moved downstairs. That was when he had the second heart attack. He died in the elevator. What did he say to you? I asked Mike. That I had to wake up my mom and make her go to the park right away or a bad man was going to kill you. Had this warning come while I was still on the phone with Lane in Mrs. Shoplaw's parlor? It couldn't have come much later or Annie wouldn't have made it in time. I asked, but Mike didn't know. As soon as the ghost went, that was a word Mike used, it didn't disappear, didn't walk out the door or use the window, it just went. He had thumbed the intercom beside his bed. When Annie answered his buzz, he started screaming. That's enough, Annie said in a tone that brooked no refusal. She was standing by the sink with her hands on her hips. I don't mind, Mom. Cough, cough. Really? Cough, cough, cough. She's right, I said. It's enough. Did Eddie appear to Mike because I saved the bad-tempered old geezer's life? It's hard to know anything about the motivation of those who've gone on, Rozzy's phrase, the caps always implied by lifted and upturned palms, but I doubt it. His reprieve only lasted a week, after all, and he sure didn't spend those last few days in the Caribbean being waited on by topless honeys. But I had come to visit him, and except for maybe Fred Dean, I was the only one who did. I even brought him a picture of his ex-wife. Sure, he'd called her a miserable, scolding, backbiting cunt, and maybe she was, but at least I'd made the effort. In the end, so had he, for whatever reason. As we drove to the airport, Mike leaned forward from the back seat and said, You want to know something funny, Dev? He never once called you by name. He just called you the kiddo. I guess he figured I'd know who he meant. I guessed so, too. Eddie fucking Parks. Those are the things that happened once upon a time and long ago. In a magical year when oil sold for $11 a barrel. The year I got my damn heart broke. The year I lost my virginity. The year I saved a nice little girl from choking and a fairly nasty old man from dying of a heart attack. The first one, at least. The year a madman almost killed me on a Ferris wheel. The year I wanted to see a ghost and didn't. Although I guess at least one of them saw me. That was also the year I learned to talk a secret language and how to dance the hokey pokey in a dog costume. The year I discovered that there are worse things than losing the girl. The year I was 21 and still a greenie. The world has given me a good life since then. I won't deny it. But sometimes I hate the world anyway. Dick Cheney, that apologist for waterboarding and for too long chief preacher in the Holy Church of whatever it takes, got a brand new heart while I was writing this. How about that? He lives on. Other people have died. Talented ones like Clarence Clemens. Smart ones like Steve Jobs. Decent ones like my old friend Tom Kennedy. Mostly you get used to it. You pretty much have to. As W.H. Auden pointed out, the Reaper takes the rolling in money, the screamingly funny, and those who are very well hung. But that isn't where Auden starts his list. He starts with the innocent young, which brings us to Mike. I took a seedy off-campus apartment when I went back to school for the spring semester. One chilly night in late March, as I was cooking a stir-fry for myself and this girl I was just about crazy for, the phone rang. I answered it in my usual jokey way. Wormwood Arms, Devin Jones, proprietor. Dev, it's Annie Ross.
Annie, wow! Hold on a second, just let me turn down the radio.
Jennifer, the girl I was just about crazy for, gave me an inquiring look. I shot her a wink and a smile and picked up the phone.
I'll be there 2 days after spring break starts, and you can tell them that's a promise. I'm going to buy my ticket next week.
Dev, stop. Stop. I picked up on the dull sorrow in her voice and all my happiness at hearing from her collapsed into dread. I put my forehead against the wall and closed my eyes. What I really wanted to close was the ear with the phone pressed to it.
Mike died last evening, Dev.
Her voice wavered, then steadied. He spiked a fever 2 days ago. The doctor said we ought to get him into the hospital. Just to be safe, he said. He seemed to be getting better yesterday, coughing less, sitting up and watching TV, talking about some big basketball tournament. Then, last night, she stopped. I could hear the rasp of her breath as she tried to get herself under control. I was also trying, but the tears had started. They were warm, almost hot. It was very sudden, she said. Then so softly I could barely hear, my heart is breaking. There was a hand on my shoulder, Jennifer's. I covered it with my own. I wondered who was in Chicago to put a hand on Annie's shoulder. Is your father there?
On a crusade in Phoenix. He's coming tomorrow.
Your brothers?
George is here now. Phil's supposed to arrive on the last flight from Miami. George and I are at the place. The place where they... I can't watch it happen. Even though it's what he wanted.
She was crying hard now. I had no idea what she was talking about.
Annie, what can I do?
Anything. Anything at all.
She told me.
Let's end on a sunny day in April of 1974. Let's end on that short stretch of North Carolina beach that lies between the town of Heaven's Bay and Joyland, an amusement park that would close its doors 2 years later. The big parks finally drove it to bankruptcy in spite of all Fred Dean's and Brenda Rafferty's efforts to save it. Let's end with a pretty woman in faded jeans and a young man in a University of New Hampshire sweatshirt. The young man is holding something in one hand. Lying at the end of the boardwalk with his snout on one paw is a Jack Russell Terrier who seems to have lost all his former bounce. On the picnic table, where the woman once served fruit smoothies, there's a ceramic urn. It looks sort of like a vase missing its bouquet. We're not quite ending where we began, but close enough. Close enough. I'm on the outs with my father again, Annie said, and this time there's no grandson to hold us together. When he got back from his damn crusade and found out that I had had Mike cremated, he was furious. She smiled wanly. If he hadn't stayed for that last goddamn revival, he might have talked me out of it. Probably would have. But it's what Mike wanted. Strange request for a kid, isn't it? But yes, he was very clear. And we both know why. Yes, we did. The last good time always comes, and when you see the darkness creeping towards you, you hold on to what was bright and good. You hold on for dear life.
Did you even ask your dad to come?
Actually, I did. It's what Mike would have wanted. Daddy refused to participate in what he called a pagan ceremony. And I'm glad. She took my hand. This is for us, Dev. Because we were here when he was happy. I raised her hand to my lips, kissed it, gave it a brief squeeze, and let it go. He saved my life as much as you did, you know. If he hadn't woken you up, if he'd even hesitated. I know. Eddie couldn't have done anything for me without Mike. I don't see ghosts or hear them. Mike was a medium. This is hard, she said. Just so hard to let him go. Even the little bit that's left. Are you sure you want to go through with it?
Yes.
Well, I still can. She took the urn from the picnic table. Milo raised his head to look at it,
then lowered it back to his paw. I don't know if he understood Mike's remains were inside, but he knew Mike was gone, all right. That he knew damn well. I held out the Jesus kite with the back to her. There, as per Mike's instructions, I had taped a small pocket big enough to hold maybe half a cup of fine gray ash. I held it open while Annie tipped the urn. When the pocket was full, she planted the urn in the sand between her feet and held out her hands. I gave her the reel of twine and turned toward Joyland, where the Carolina Spin dominated the horizon. "I'm flying," he'd said that day, lifting his arms over his head. No braces to hold him down then, and none now. I believe that Mike was a lot wiser than his Christ-minded grandfather. Wiser than all of us, maybe. Was there ever a crippled kid who didn't want to fly? Just once. I looked at Annie. She nodded that she was ready. I lifted the kite and let it go. It rose at once on a brisk, chilly breeze off the ocean. We followed its ascent with our eyes. "You," she said and held out her hands. "This part is for you, Dev." He said so. I took the twine, feeling the pull as the kite, now alive, rose above us, nodding back and forth against the blue. Annie picked up the urn and carried it down the sandy slope. I guess she dumped it there at the edge of the ocean, but I was watching the kite. And once I saw the thin gray streamer of ash running away from it, carried into the sky on the breeze, I let the string go free. I watched the untethered kite go up, and up, and up. Mike would have wanted to see how high it would go before it disappeared. And I did, too. I wanted to see that, too. August 24th, 2012.
Joyland was written by Stephen King and read by Michael Kelly. It was recorded at CDM Studios in New York City by Andrew Thomas and Ethan Donaldson. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Joyland was produced and directed by Christina Zarafanidis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Wind Through the Keyhole, written and read by Stephen King, and 11-22-63, written by Stephen King and read by Craig Wasson.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.